Good morning. I'm speaking with Amanda Frost, the David Massey Professor of Law and Director of the Immigration, Migration, and Human Rights Program at the University of Virginia School of Law. In addition to numerous law review articles about immigration and citizenship, she has published in The Atlantic, The New York Times, Slate, The American Prospect, and many other publications. She's author of the recent book, You Are Not American: Citizenship Stripping from Dred Scott to the Dreamers. Welcome to KABU, Professor Frost.
Thank you for having me.
Well, today, in response to the brutal ICE raids terrorizing many American cities, we often hear people claim this is not who we are. But much of your work looks at how citizenship has always been at risk and contested, and how individuals and groups of people, just like we see today, push back against restrictions and that kind of policing. Can you say something about that trajectory, perhaps beginning with the 1850s Dred Scott case and the 1868 14th Amendment?
Yes, and this is a cycle that I chronicle in the book you mentioned, You Are Not American. It's not been an unrelenting story of attempting to deny or strip citizenship. I really want to emphasize that. It's been cyclical. The story really begins in the antebellum era, where we had a constitution drafted in 1787 that did not define citizenship, and citizenship was contested throughout that antebellum era, because there were open questions about whether free Black people were citizens. Most people thought slaves, of course, were not citizens since they had no rights at all. And then what about Native Americans? What about the rights attached to citizenship for women? These were all open questions. And in 1857, the Supreme Court decided Dred Scott versus Samford, in which Chief Justice Taney spent about half his opinion addressing this question of citizenship. And he was incensed about the idea that any Black person, slave or free, could be a citizen. He said that was not constitutionally permissible. And in fact, he went even further. He suggested nobody of an inferior or subordinate class could be a citizen. And we know from his other jurisprudence that for him, that would have included certainly all people from various countries in Asia could not be citizens. And he also suggested only Christians could be citizens. So for Chief Justice Taney and people who thought like him, very few people could be considered part of we, the people, for whom the Constitution was drafted and who belonged and had a role in the United States of America. And of course, we then fought a civil war over slavery that was precipitated in part by the Dred Scott decision. And then in 1865, we emerged from that. Slavery was abolished by the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. There were over 4 million free Black people. There were immigrants arriving in large numbers. We were a nation of immigrants. And there was an open question of who counted as an American, who could be a citizen. And that was the question that was addressed by the Reconstruction Congress in 1866.
Well, how did the rejection of Dred Scott, which the 14th Amendment in granting citizenship to all Black people eliminated, and the institution of birthright citizenship usher in new debates about who should be allowed into the United States?
Yeah, so the Reconstruction Congress, emerging from that Civil War in 1866, they knew that they not only had to abolish slavery, but they also had to abolish the caste system that accompanied racialized slavery. And they recognized that we were a nation of immigrants, with immigrants arriving daily, particularly the Chinese on the West Coast, who at that time had become the vilified immigrant group. And they recognized that all of these individuals needed to be incorporated into the United States of America as equal citizens. So they did a couple things. The first, in the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the Reconstruction Congress added as a first sentence birthright citizenship for just about everybody. And I think it's particularly interesting that Senator Lyman Trumbull, who proposed the language that created universal birthright citizenship, that is, all persons born were in the US were citizens with narrow exceptions. But Lyman Trumbull first put it in terms of race. I think he said all persons of African descent are citizens. And then he rethought it. And very shortly thereafter said, no, wait, just all persons born are citizens. And in part, that's because I think he recognized that he was responding to Dred Scott and the problem of racialized slavery, which of course was first and foremost. But not only them, the goal was also to grant citizenship to everyone else, including, as I've mentioned, the children of Chinese immigrants arriving in the United States daily. And then, following that legislation, Congress added to the proposed draft of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution what is the citizenship clause, that's the shorthand for it, that all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. And that provision, which became that first sentence of the 14th Amendment and is now in our Constitution, created near universal birthright citizenship. Now, you'll notice from what I just quoted that you have to be born and subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. So, what did they mean by that? Well, the Reconstruction Congress explained who they wanted to exclude. It was these very narrow groups of people that had also been excluded under the English common law. That's the children of diplomats. That was one narrow exception. The other narrow exception was for children of invading occupying armies, which happily we haven't seen in the US for a long time. And then the last group that the Reconstruction Congress carved out from universal birthright citizenship were the children born within Native American tribes. And this is the provision they debated at greatest length. Today there's now a statute that grants birthright citizenship to children born within Native American tribes. But at the time, those tribes were viewed as separate sovereign nations, and that it would be actually antithetical to their sovereignty to grant children automatic citizenship at birth born within those tribes. But everyone else, they made clear, were birthright citizens, including the children of immigrants, and particularly the children of Chinese immigrants. That question came up, and they answered that affirmatively, yes.
Well, despite that kind of universality of birthright citizenship, certainly by the late 19th century with the Chinese Exclusion Act and then later exclusionary immigration policies tried to limit who could even be in the United States and claim that citizenship. And you've noted that 90% of citizenship stripping and immigration restrictions have been based on race. Can you just cite some examples of that kind of racialized exclusion?
Yeah, our immigration and citizenship policies as a nation have always been shot through with racial animus and racial discrimination, and that has been the primary locus of battles over citizenship and immigration. Not the sole source of debate or conflict, I should say. Women lost their citizenship for the first few decades of the 20th century if they married non-citizens, even native-born U.S. women. Another example of a non-race-based loss of citizenship includes people whose speech or conduct, particularly if they were affiliated with a communist party, led to them being denaturalized. So it wasn't solely about race, but significantly about race. So the to deal to address again the Reconstruction Congress and its debate over this, it knew, of course, that racialized slavery would lead to, even at the end of racialized slavery, a caste system based on race. They could see that the reaction to Chinese immigration was, of course, racist. And that's why they created universal birthright citizenship. Shortly thereafter, of course, the Reconstruction Congress fell out of power. At that point, the Democratic Party, which was the party of Johnson and the party of that embraced racial discrimination in various ways, shapes, and forms, took power. And they put in place the Chinese Exclusion Act. And this was in response to anti-Chinese animus on the West Coast, which had seen both a rise in Chinese immigration and an economic downturn that resulted in legislation restricting Chinese immigration. And of course, we saw after that restrictions in the 1920s that barred almost all Asians from immigrating to the United States, barred almost all people from Africa from immigrating to the United States, and significantly restricted immigrants from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe, who were also viewed in racialized terms and rejected as Americans.
And those policies were changed in the 1960s as a result of civil rights movements and Americans pushing back on those kinds of racist restrictions. So I think your book also really emphasizes the pushback and among individuals and groups of people who have always resisted these kinds of restrictions.
Yeah, and that's one thing, that's a point I tried to make in the book, which is while there's certainly a through line here of racist policies seeking to exclude, there's equally a through line of people fighting back. Of course, the targeted individuals and groups themselves, in particular, I have to say, Chinese immigrants and their descendants were enormously successful litigants who fought back in every way, shape, and form, including in the courts, and often won their cases. Women who lost their citizenship fought back first in the courts and then in Congress. And of course, by getting the right to vote in the 1920s, that was enormously helpful to successfully encouraging and lobbying Congress to end the restrictions on their citizenship. As I mentioned before, US citizen women who married non-citizen men for several decades automatically lost their citizenship. So we see lots of examples of the targeted groups fighting back and also other Americans stepping up to represent and help them. So while the story certainly has its dark side, I think it's also important to acknowledge how often people responded by saying, no, that's what it means to be an American is that you're here and you're born here. It is not about race or lineage or ancestry.
Well, let's talk about what is new and not new about Trump's immigration policies. What is the Trump administration attempting that is novel? Are they going further than some of these anti-immigration forces of the past have gone?
Well, I'll focus in my answer on the birthright citizenship litigation, which is now currently pending in the US Supreme Court. And first, we'll go back in time a little bit. We already talked about Chinese exclusion and anti-Chinese animus. So, in addition to the Chinese Exclusion Act, which barred Chinese immigrants in the 1880s from coming to the United States or laborers, in addition, the US government decided that it was going to try to challenge birthright citizenship for the children of Chinese immigrants. It viewed that automatic citizenship that the Constitution guaranteed to children of Chinese immigrants as a loophole in the Chinese Exclusion Act. And the US government brought a case before the US Supreme Court, United States versus Wong Kim Ark, and they challenged Wong Kim Ark's citizenship. Wong Kim Ark had been born to Chinese immigrants. He'd lived in the United States most of his life. He was American at birth, and he knew it. But the government argued that no, he wasn't, and they tried to interpret the Constitution, or they argued the Constitution should be interpreted to exclude the children of all immigrants from being citizens. And I've looked at the correspondence. It's clear they were targeting the children of Chinese immigrants, but these government officials couldn't find a way to read the citizenship clause in our Constitution in the race-based way it wanted. So instead, it had to take this fairly sweeping position that would have unwound the citizenship of thousands of people, if not tens or hundreds of thousands, in the United States. It was actually a close case. It was not clear the government was going to lose, but it did lose 6-2 after more than a year of deliberation in the Supreme Court. That was back in 1898. Since then, we have a pretty much unbroken tradition of agreeing as a nation that we have a guarantee of universal birthright citizenship, a constitutional right that ensures that, of course, the newly freed slaves were integrated into the United States, but also that the children of immigrants are integrated into the United States. And in fact, that's something the United States does extremely well. The children of immigrants flourish. They are more than half the leaders of Fortune 500 companies. They are a part of our reason we're an economic powerhouse. And that brings us to January 20th, 2025, when President Trump took office. He had mentioned in his first term he wanted to end birthright citizenship. And indeed, he did it day one. He signed an executive order. Arguing that the citizenship clause has been misinterpreted for more than a century now, and that in fact it excludes children of two groups that have always been granted citizenship. One is the children of undocumented immigrants, and the other is children of temporary immigrants. Now, that doesn't just mean children born to tourists, that also means children born to student visa holders, people on H-1B visas, which are skilled workers. It includes people who've been here for many years. It includes people who are applying for green cards while living in the United States, which is very typical, right? Someone might come, get a PhD in the United States under a student visa, maybe start working under an H-1B visa, maybe get married to a US citizen or get an employer to sponsor them, and then they apply for a green card. And so it's quite common that someone who's on a temporary visa has been here for years and is fully integrated. And yet, according to the Trump administration, these people's children are born without US citizenship and possibly stateless, and certainly could be deported on day one of their lives. So this is the argument the Trump administration is making in the US Supreme Court. They've made it in the lower courts and lost in every court, including in front of judges appointed by Republican presidents. And now we're going to see what the Supreme Court says about it this spring.
Just the implementation of that seems kind of unimaginable, how children born in the country, how people would determine who belongs, who should be kicked out. How do you do that with babies? It just seems really pretty far-fetched.
Yeah, and one point I always try to point out to people is over 3 million, I think it's about 3.5 million children are born in the United States every year. So under the Trump administration's interpretation of the Citizenship Clause, the estimates are about 230,000 children would be born going forward who would not be citizens under the Trump administration's view. So that's 230,000 new unauthorized immigrants every year because they wouldn't have status, who are at risk of being deported, creating a brand new problem that we don't have, right? But in addition to that, everyone else, doesn't matter whether your ancestors have been here since the Mayflower, every single person who has a child will now have to demonstrate their ancestry, their lineage, their immigration or citizenship status to the satisfaction of the US government before their child will be considered a citizen. Children, sometimes these newborns need medical care. And again, they wouldn't qualify for any kind of government support or government aid for that medical care unless they can first prove their child is a citizen. Again, requiring this kind of paperwork and proof. And it would be hard enough right now, but if this goes into effect, conceivably, if your grandparent or your great grandparent was either came to the US without permission or was a temporary immigrant when your ancestor was born, then you aren't a citizen and your child isn't a citizen. The argument would unwind the citizenship of a nation, of immigrants, which is what we are. And for that reason, it seems like antithetical to everything the Reconstruction Congress wanted to accomplish and would create chaos for not just children of immigrants, but children of all individuals living in the United States.
Well, it's clearly a policy of white supremacy, and we've seen that over and over again with how ICE has been policing certain kinds of immigrants based on color of their skin and accents, and the rapid admission of white South Africans. So this kind of racism that at times has peppered U.S. history and its immigration and citizenship policies has now been emphasized by the Trump administration. And just as birthright citizenship has been upheld over a century, naturalization and the naturalization process is another long time or long held affirmation of American citizenship that seems to be under attack in the Trump administration. Can you say something about some of these attacks on the naturalization process?
Yeah, just to give a little history, in the 1790s, the United States enacted a naturalization law, and that law allowed for fairly lenient naturalization, that is, the acquiring of citizenship by those who were immigrants who were born non-citizens, but it was only for free white persons. That's the language in the statute. So you had to be white to be allowed to be a citizen or to become a citizen. And then, of course, we added this Birthright Citizenship Clause to the Constitution in 1868 at a moment of in which the Reconstruction era, the Reconstruction Congress, was seeking to end these kinds of race-based exclusionary rules and laws and practices. But when it came to updating the naturalization law in 1870, Congress balked. It didn't do it. It added that you could become a citizen if you were of African descent, you could naturalize, and still you could do so if you were white, but no one else could, which is just bizarre. And for the next 40 years, there was debate in the courts who counted as white. And they had such difficulty defining and determining who was white. So Asians would attempt to naturalize, Arabs, all of these groups. And there was this debate, were they white? Were they not? Could they naturalize? It was farcical and would be funny, except of course it was tragic. And actually, I have to say, I think World War II and Hitler kind of helped the United States see the errors of its ways. And it wasn't until 1943, in the middle of that war, that the United States amended the naturalization laws to allow Chinese immigrants to naturalize. Of course, Japanese immigrants had also been barred from naturalizing, and your listeners may be familiar with the Japanese internment that occurred during World War II, when people of Japanese descent, whether they were immigrants or native-born US citizens of Japanese descent, they were rounded up and imprisoned, again, applying these racist assumptions about who could or could not be a loyal American. Happily, we ended that shameful era. The last racial restriction on naturalization was ended in 1952. And today, anyone can naturalize of any race. However, what we've seen under the Trump administration is an effort to ramp up denaturalization, that is, taking away citizenship from people who acquired it through the naturalization process. The government tried to do this during the Cold War era based on people's political beliefs and membership in the Communist Party, et cetera. Eventually, the Supreme Court ended that practice in a case called Afrin versus Rusk in 1967. And they said, look, you really can never take away citizenship, with the exception if there's some sort of fraud or error in granting citizenship. The Trump administration, though, it, certainly in the first Trump administration, tried to take advantage of this by very aggressively pursuing denaturalization, even of people for whom there'd been minor errors or inadvertent mistakes in the naturalization process. It was investigating about 700,000 naturalized citizens to see whether there'd been a flaw or error in their process. And it was trying to ramp it up. It didn't succeed. There were not the thousands of cases they might have wanted to bring. And there's been talk about ramping up denaturalization again in under Trump too. Again, so far, it has not succeeded. We're not seeing hundreds or thousands of cases being brought, but it's out there as a risk.
Well, this has all been very illuminating, Professor Amanda Frost. You've given us a primer of the history of citizenship and citizenship stripping. So thanks so much for taking time to speak with us today.
Thank you for having me.